And it was very helpful to have not me telling the story of why this was a good thing. It didn't show up as, you know, I want to do this for the benefit of the leaders.
Welcome to Boardroom Confidential, a podcast by Sherpany where business leaders tell the stories they usually only share with their peers. Each episode, we have three items on the agenda: pressure, lessons, and boardroom dynamics. I'm Emily Sheffield, journalist, broadcaster, and former newspaper editor and board member. And I'm looking forward to sitting down with senior leaders to talk about what really goes on behind the boardroom doors when the pressure's on and the stakes are high. Joining me this week is Jorge Tittinger. Jorge has and continues to serve on multiple public, private, and non-profit boards and has significant experience in the semiconductor and computer industries. He spent 4 years as president and CEO of SGI, one of the leading global companies in high-performance computing, and served as CEO of Verigy. He served on the board of the Hispanic Foundation of Silicon Valley and the board of Stanford Children's Hospital. Welcome to the podcast, Jorge.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
So let's start with agenda item number one, boardroom pressure. Now, having done my research on you, Jorge, I know you have had periods of considerable pressure. But tell me about, I suppose, the most pressurized out of your sort of long experience.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I've been on, you said, multiple private, public, nonprofit boards, and I think in total around 23 boards. And so you can imagine I've seen most everything. And one of the situations is we were involved in a strategic conversation with a different company, and the process takes a long time. You know, it was about 6 months of negotiations, and halfway through, there was kind of a shift in the board dynamic where initially they were not too much in favor of the transaction, and then, you know, as the price went up, they were completely in favor of the transaction.
Is this you taking over a company or them trying to take you over?
Yeah, the opposite. It's the closest to, you know, I call it a bear hug. You know, it's the closest to a hostile that I've seen. There was a shift in the board. So first against it, then for it. And, you know.
For the takeover. For the bear hug.
For the bear hug. And then they found out that in that particular country, the boards are comprised mostly of senior executives in the company, not independent board members. And so that created an incredibly confusing dynamic where people, we actually kind of split into two factions, right? Those for, those against. It creates a very difficult situation. By the way, I was the CEO at the time and board member. So I had to maneuver through that and get everybody to...
So essentially, your board became split down the middle at this point.
Not unanimous. Let's put it that way, right?
Yeah. Where were you standing at the time, because you're the CEO? So
yeah. Well, so you know, this partly why I call it a bear hug is, you know, they made an initial play. We turned it down because we had another thing going on that I thought was going to be better. They said, you know, if you don't want to do this, we'll go away. Well, they didn't go away, right? They came back a month later with a little better offer. I still turned it down, which created all kinds of concerns for a lot of shareholders. And then they came back with an offer you can't refuse, right? Literally a massive premium for a company like ours. I call those mafia offers, right? Offer you can't refuse. So at that point, literally, you know, as the CEO of a public company, you're number one, not number one, but one of the key responsibilities to maximize return for a shareholder. So that was, that was an incredible return. And so I was in favor of doing it. And it was, you know, you need to have unanimity, you know, when it comes to this, right? And so there was a lot of work in understanding and showing the faction of the board that was against it that this was absolutely the right thing to do. And we came out that way, right? So this did happen, but it created a incredibly tense environment in the board and with the leadership team, because they're counting on something definitive, right? And it just adds uncertainty when you're going through those periods of time.
And how did you? So when the board is split, mm-hmm. and you were also moving positions or slowly coming to formulate your final position, mm-hmm. how are you bringing the board with you?
You know, and when the initial offer was turned down, everybody was in alignment because we were actually looking at a different transaction that I thought could produce better results than an initial offer. When the second offer came around, it was kind of the threshold at which we were going like, you know, this is could go either way. But when the third offer came around, it was literally a no-brainer. I mean, it was such a nice premium on the stock that for me, there was no question this is the right thing to do. Clearly, until it's done, it's not done, right? So there was always the risk of being able to close the deal. But we didn't see much concern about that. So my position was very clear. I work with individually with the board members that were not so much in support of this.
So you used to work with them one by one, and that was
And we normally were working as a whole board. And then when this kind of split happened, it was clear to me that I had to go one by one, right? Luckily, the chairman was in alignment with me, so he was very helpful. We had to remind people that why does the board exist, and why do we as a fiduciary of the stakeholders exist, and what are we going to do? And show them that all the plans that we had laid out for the next few years, if executed perfectly, wouldn't get to that premium. You know, we get close with a lot of execution risk, but we wouldn't get to that premium. And that's when the board started to get fully aligned. But it was, lots of meetings, lots of late nights, lots of discussions. But
how often were the board meeting at this stage? And you said you were listed. What was your share price doing? I assume rumors were abounding
center. When the offer is made, because he has to go out, typically the share prices freeze. Right, they don't move much. So the share price was where it had been. It was fine. And if the market thinks it's going to happen, they'll move it close to what the offer might be. If the market thinks it's not going to happen, it goes down. Ours, moved up a little bit. But we normally meet 5 times a year, right? 4 quarterly meetings plus a strategy meeting and then, committee meetings, et cetera, et cetera. At the time, we were meeting close to daily, which was fine. It adds to the pressure of having to continue to conduct the business because until the combination happens, you still need to run the company.
Yeah. And that is where your focus is at that point too. So,
yeah. And so I developed a split personality of, one is focused on the business and the other one, at night kind of focused on driving this conversation with the help of the chairman. And the end result was very good, but it was, one of the key lessons, I know we're going to talk about lessons later, but, one of the key lessons is kind of having the pulse of the board at all times and educating them because the board.
Board members often have different strengths, don't they?
Well, and they're different in different countries. Mm. Right. And in this particular country, because the company was a foreign company, it wasn't the same as in the US. Here, almost 100% of the focus is the shareholders. There it was, customers, employees, all stakeholders. And so it gave them broader leeway, which, it was interesting. But I think a lot of our board didn't know that.
Yeah. No, it's a rise, that there's a rise of shareholder power. It's a sort of very interesting conversation, but for another time. But you mentioned the chairman a few times. You've been a chairman and you've sat on the board and been a CEO, but in this particular sort of circumstance, how important, how vital was the chairman and you's relationship, and how was he helpful to you? Because, I've been on a board where we've had to go into meetings every single day and it can be quite relentless because, of course, if you're a board member, you've actually You're doing other things.
Yeah. yes.
So what do you think, what if you could narrow it down, what were the sort of key attributes that chairman was bringing to this sort of highly pressured period?
So let me make a statement first. You know, I think the relationship between the CEO and the chairman is essential no matter at what point in time in the company you are, right? It really is so much better if there's a great relationship, right? Because, you know, the boards are there really to help steer and guide. And, you know, if there's not a collegial and relationship, that alone can become difficult. In this particular case, the chairman was a industry veteran, understood the value of this combination, understood the dynamics of what the board might look like if we were combined, because it would be a board in a foreign country. And he was very helpful, you know, in helping me, helping me tell the story, because a lot of times, boards worry about the leadership being entrenched in either direction, right? We want to sell, we don't want to sell, right? And it was very helpful to have not me telling the story of why this was a good thing. It didn't show up as, you know, I want to do this for the benefit of the leadership, right? So that was, I think, a very helpful dynamic that existed during those conversations. And it really helped. And he also knew the board, you know, he had recruited several of the board members. You know, when I became CEO, I inherited that board. So he had longer relationships with the board. That was also very helpful.
Mm. And the depth of experience across the board. I mean, you know, this was a big company. And
yeah.
You were public and yeah. We won't go into the details, but I mean, the sale was big, especially back in the year we're talking about.
Yes.
How much did the experience of the board come into play? Were there a lot of veterans there as well? So yes. Everyone kept their cool. You know, we were having grown-up conversations, not too many egos in the room.
No, I'm not going to say that, the last part, but no, very experienced board. You know, we actually had several ex-CEOs, a couple of current CEOs. So the very mature board.
Mm.
You know, I joke when I said I'm going to not agree with the last comment. You know, people, when they get to these roles, at some level, they have to have strong egos, right? Otherwise, it's easy to derail folks, because it isn't just a, you know, up and up and to the right path, right? You have to be resilient. You have to have grit. And that helps when you have confidence, and with that comes egos. And and I think a lot of times people think they know better, right? But we did have an excellent experienced board, and that was helpful in getting to alignment.
Now that brings us very, very neatly to our agenda item number two, which is lessons. You know, I wonder if we could sort of focus on recruitment a bit.
You know, I've been on a board where, you know, one of the board members was brilliant, but loved to do intellectual sparring for the sake of sport, if you will. And so it created tough dynamics during the meeting and after the meeting. And you know, we had to clean up the mess after every board meeting, right? And so the challenge was there were pearls of wisdom in the middle of all the BS that were tremendously valuable. And so the goal was, how do we actually, you know, eliminate or significantly reduce that kind of behavior, and at the same time keep the pearls, right? You know, again, back to the relationship between whether it's the chairman or lead independent and the CEO, it's tremendously helpful. And you know, in the end, I think sometimes people don't realize they're doing this, right? And so in this particular case, it was a, you know, multiple times, but in the end, you know, sitting down with this person, kind of going as a, why, you know, your points were great. Why in that style, right? There was no need for that style. And this is going to sound funny, but we developed a sign, right? When he started going a certain way, I would do a certain wave, right? That he was like, oh, so he stopped. Now, and I actually ended up sitting right next to him at every board meeting. So, you know, the kicking under the table thing, it works, right? But, you know, it took a couple of board meetings for me to realize this was going to be chronic.
Has there ever been a moment when you know, you've got all this experience on the board, but you're in such a tricky situation that's new to all of you, you actually haven't had the answer? And how have you worked through that?
Absolutely. And, you know, again, I'm not naming names for the benefit of the innocent, if you will. I was on a board where we, you know, where the CEO was convicted of a crime, right? White collar crime, but, and nobody on the board had faced, by the way, he was accused of a crime. Okay. And we didn't know what to do. Right. And we're kind of looking around the table going, well, who's dealt with something like this before? And nobody had. And, you know, it's there's the saying, and that turns into a reality, is, you know, innocent and proven guilty, right?
Yeah.
And so here we're sitting with the CEO, who happened to have been the founder, with this accusation, and a board that had no experience in dealing with that. I think we resolved it appropriately, which we put the person on a leave of absence until there was a verdict, right? But it was very uncomfortable to be associated with that company. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depends on how you look at it, the person was convicted. And so we were right in kind of removing him from the role.
Yeah.
Immediately, right?
Yeah.
It's one of those things that everybody's looking at around the table going, so who suggests what to do from experience? Yeah. Nobody had the experience. So,
but do you think at that moment, it's almost, there are lots of guidelines, you know, there are lots of very firm governance guidelines around being on a board. I would have thought at that point, those are quite helpful, actually, those guardrails, because
yeah.
When your experience runs out, you can just return to the guardrail. I'm here to do a job.
Yeah.
It's governance.
Well, which is what we ended up leveraging, but you know, the initial couple of days was, you know, deer in the headlight, right? And the net was, you know, this is impacting the reputation of the company
and the board.
And even, you know, so if this turns to be incorrect accusation, then, you know, we would have been ready to reinstate the person. But at that time, it was the right decision. We came to that conclusion fairly quickly, within a week. But it, you know, we had a very good legal counsel as well that helped us with that, right? So this is when...
Yeah, when bringing the experts in is important, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. I've got friends who've sat on boards where things have gone that way, and it is hard. Really tough. So agenda item number 3 is boardroom dynamics. Now, succession planning has come up in previous episodes as well, and I understand you... have experience of seeing succession planning go wrong. Maybe you want to touch on both, though, when it's gone wrong and how does a board get it right?
Yeah, I've not had experience with it gone wrong, but I've had experience, by the way, my first CEO job was in a succession plan. I've had experience where we're going through a very excellent plan for succession and all of a sudden the sitting CEO change their mind, right? No, I don't want to go. And so it added, again, back to pressure and boardroom dynamics, it added an element of complication that wasn't foreseen before. You know, it added time to the plan. You know, we went from the outgoing CEO being a very, very strong supporter of the potential successor to kind of flipping and going, well, you know, it's not got the experience, et cetera. And again, tremendously helpful that the board was able to coalesce, very experienced board again. And it got resolved. And by the way, it's been a very, very successful succession. But, you know, those are the times when it gets tricky, right? And those are times where it gets tough. And I think a lot of people think it's an easy job, right? Oh, you show up to 5 meetings or 4 meetings, you know. In my experience, on a board that is just working without crisis, it typically takes about 200 hours a year to be informed, to go to the meetings, subcommittee meetings, committee meetings, travel if you need to travel, read all the material, etc. You know, 200 hours a year is not insignificant. And if you're not prepared, it's very obvious.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the board members that show up unprepared, you know, it's easy to detect them, which, again, you know, it's a lot of commitment of time. It's a lot of, like you said, the role is very important in guiding companies. And so people really ought to take it seriously. And when I, you know, one of the things I do is I help companies with their governance and coach CEOs, that, and many of them want to be on boards. And I eliminate the false illusion that this is easy work. You know, it's...
Yeah. I'd like to get on to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that's obviously going through a period of flux in America right now. But the first board I sat on, I don't know whether the chairman planned it that way, but I, to this day, it's still the most diverse board I ever sat on. Diverse in every way. And it was brilliant. And the talent was fantastic. And thank God, because, you know, this was a company that went up, it went down, it went up. How important do you think diversity, equity, and inclusion is? And when you're coaching people, what are you coaching them around that?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, I co-wrote a book on that topic specifically, right? Which is, it is called Differences That Make a Difference. And it was about how diversity, equity, and inclusion, and then we added belonging to the acronym, impacted bottom line results of companies. And we interviewed about 130 senior executives, CEOs from different, you know, public service, independent companies, a few people in other countries, et cetera. And the data was so amazing. And, you know, in some of the quotes that, you know, that we quoted, all these people that we interviewed, and some of the quotes were brilliant, way more brilliant than what I could have come up with. And you know, I don't remember who said this, but, you know, one of them is, you know, why do you think Silicon Valley is the most creative place in the world? And it's because we have people from 130 countries that all come with an attitude to contribute. And that, again, the data show that, you know, and it's both boards, leadership teams, and then it needs to go down as well, right? But the companies that had above average diversity and inclusion in gender and ethnicity outperforms those that were low by like 30%, not 3%, 30% bottom line performance, right? And I think what it is you get different experiences, you get different ways of thinking, and they contribute to better solutions, right? Better access to talent, better connectivity to your market, because unless you're in a place that I don't know, your market is diverse, right? I know it was one of the senior executives at Intel who said, every time somebody asked me to make a case for diversity, I ask him to make a case for homogeneity. And that was brilliant, right, in my opinion. And another one of the quotes that I loved was somebody who said, you know, diversity is being asked to the dance, inclusion is being asked to dance. And I really believe it's it produces much better results.
Jorge, it's been such a pleasure hearing your stories and your insights. We'd like to finish with one final question. If you could go back to your first board meeting, if you can remember your first board meeting, what would you tell yourself?
Remember, they're on your side. You know, my first board meeting, you know, I was as high level executive in a company, and we were fairly acquisitive, right? So typically we would invest 19%, because I think when it's 20 or higher, you have to include their financials in your income statements. And we typically got our board seat by doing that investment. And one of the senior executives in the company talked about the board as if it were this, you know, alien body that was kind of esoteric and whatnot. And so my first board meeting, I was going like, oh my God, right? I experienced this whole imposter syndrome thing. It was like, am I ready? Do I know what to do? Do I ask questions? Okay, keep quiet, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I go to the actual board meeting and it was like, hey, so what do you think? Right. So I would tell myself, and I would tell anybody who's going to go to our first board meeting, is remember, they're on your side. You know, they're there to win, to help you win. And their questions are for you to hone your thinking, not to just be challenging for no reason.
Jorge Tissinger, thank you so much for sharing your boardroom stories with us and giving us your time and commitment.
Thank you, Emily. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Boardroom Confidential, a podcast by Sherpany. Sherpany is a leading meeting management solution designed to meet the unique needs of the board, board committee, and executive meetings. Find out more at sherpany.com and make sure you subscribe to the Boardroom Confidential podcast to hear more business leaders tell the stories they usually only share with their peers.